switching gears a little bit, during your time at the White House, your portfolio grew even beyond communications and speech writing, and you became an emissary for the president to deliver messages directly. And I think one of the most fascinating examples, you were one of the two members of the administration who were tapped to lead the secret negotiations to restore diplomatic relations with Cuba. And I'm wondering if you could tell us, you know, you held these talks in secret in Canada, of all places. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that. How many people in the world knew about these talks when you started, and what kind of lies did you have to tell Anne and everybody else, as Ben's wife, when you disappeared to Canada and came back smelling like Cuban cigars and rum?
Well, actually, on the last point, what used to drive me crazy is the Cubans are very gregarious. and so they would always give us cigars and rum as gifts, but we could never accept them because, like, you know, for a couple reasons. One, I think it exceeded the legal limit of cigars I could bring in the country. But two, which, by the way, we've changed. Now you can bring as many Cuban cigars as you want.
Thanks, Obama.
Yeah, thanks, Obama. But also because, like, you know, how would kind of blow my cover story if I started showing up with boxes of Cuban cigars and rum. So I'd always give the Canadians these gifts, which, you know, they deserve for hosting us. It was very strange because, you know, we did a lot of meetings. I think before the announcement, we did something like 12 or 15 meetings, and we subsequently had many more after the announcement. But the first couple, I think I tried to invent some story, like I was out for this reason or doing something. And then they were so frequent that I just started – like I just wouldn't show up to work. You know? And I wouldn't tell anybody why. And people like didn't really ask. But what was strange – you know, the strangest part about it is there's an expectation in your job that you're going to be responsive. You know, So I'd go into these – 8-hour sessions, you know, and we'd take a break after 3 hours, and I'd have like 300 emails, including like reporters.
Right.
And
Ben Rhodes never emails me back.
Yeah. So thankfully, I already had a reputation for not emailing some people back. But so I tried to kind of respond enough so it looked like I wasn't off the grid because I didn't want to say I was out of the country because they'd be like, well, where are you? Right. So, you know, I just try to do enough to make it appear like I wasn't totally. Off the grid in a way that would raise suspicions. I frankly had this moment of dread every time I walked through Dulles Airport that I was going to run into somebody. Miraculously, the secret held. And I got to say, the Canadians were really good about this because they knew it needed to be secret. I mean, at the beginning in the White House, there were probably less than 10 people who knew about this. Wow. And nobody outside of the White House knew about it. And unless our intelligence community probably knew about it because they have their own ways of knowing things. But and then like the Canadians kept it really tight. And when we would get there, they would kind of meet us at the gate. Some amiable Canadian would kind of hustle us through immigration or whatever we had to pass through and then kind of put us in a car and drive us about an hour outside of Ottawa to this facility they had. And, you know, you'd have these meetings and they'd be sandwiches at lunch, and then you'd not be able to take your Cuban cigars and rum, and you'd go back and get on the plane.
Were those conversations contentious? Are these people going to be your friends for life? Like, what's the vibe in the room?
The vibe in the room at the beginning was really, I don't want to say contentious, but it was what you'd think, which is they wanted to debate like the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Oh my God,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, I spent, you know, the first. I think I described the first meeting as an 8-hour throat clearing exercise where they would. You know, every crime in their view that the United States had committed, you know, from the Bay of Pigs to assassination efforts on Fidel Castro to Miami-backed groups that
it's
sought
like
to –
greatest hits album. You
know, yeah, it was just a greatest hits album of Cuban grievances. And instead of kind of like debating every point, I'd just be like, guys – I mean, this is where, you know, my youth was helpful because I'd just be like, guys, I wasn't even born when that happened. You know, like I'm here to talk about the future. And, you know, President Obama wasn't even born when some of this stuff happened. And that kind of sunk in. And you know, after they had kind of gotten it off their chest the first two or three meetings, we kind of bore down on the things we were trying to solve and then realized actually we could be much more ambitious. You know, we were just trying to get Alan Gross out of prison at first. But then we realized, well, we got an opening here. These people, you know, are actually ready to talk about the whole relationship. And so the ambition grew over the course of the negotiations. And yeah, we did develop really good relationships with these guys. I mean, that doesn't mean I agree with them at everything, but that's the only way you're going to get anything done in diplomacy.
Yeah. I've heard you talk about when you went to the Vatican, both with President Obama and I think unilaterally, to brief them on these efforts. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that the Vatican has, you know, long supported better relations between the U.S. and Cuba, and that only got more the case with Pope Francis because he was, you know, he's from Latin America. He's from Argentina. So, you know, everybody in Latin America wants there to be better relations between the United States and Cuba, which is one of the reasons why to do it, frankly. But when we went to the Vatican with President Obama in, I think, March of 14, you know, the Pope talked to him about Cuba more than any issue. And Obama kind of said to him, look, you know, we've got something going, actually, which he had not yet said to any other leader. And it'd be great if you could be helpful. And we basically communicated to them that they, if they would offer that assistance formally, that would be useful. You know, so we ended up getting a letter sent to Obama and Raul Castro that was essentially the same letter that said, we're ready to be helpful as it relates to efforts to resolve prisoner issues, which to us is Alan Gross, and the Cubans was a handful of people in prison in the United States.
Alan Gross was a USAID contractor who had been detained for 4 or 5 years at that point?
That's right. He was a USAID subcontractor who was working on kind of democracy programming, detained early in our administration. And we knew we couldn't politically, I mean, humanitarian-wise, we wanted him out for his sake. And politically, we weren't going to improve relations with Cuba while a guy like that was in prison. And also offering to be helpful on the broader relationship. When we went back to the Vatican in October of 14, we had actually basically finalized a series of agreements that were then announced in December. So the Vatican was really surprised by that. Like they didn't know like we were that far along. I think they thought they were hosting a meeting when in fact – and they were, and we were there for several hours. But they instead were essentially receiving these commitments we'd made, which, by the way, that was the role they played that was indispensable because, you know, we can't trust each other. You know, how could they trust that we were going to do what we said? How could we trust that they were going to do what they said? So if we deposited those commitments at the Vatican, they were essentially a guarantor. Nobody could go back on something that they told the Pope. You know? And the Vatican could have come out and said, well, wait a second. These guys told us they were going to do X and they didn't. And so that's why, you know, and only they could play that role because they have a degree of respect and neutrality in both countries and around the world. And so it's like really emotional because, you know, they were overwhelmed. I remember there was one Vatican official who was like in tears because he lived and worked in Cuba. And it gave me an initial impression of, as to how big a deal this is going to be around the world. And the weird thing about it is, you know, I'm relatively anonymous. You know, I'm not John Kerry when I go someplace. So when I walked out of the Vatican, I'm just some guy walking down the street in Rome. You know, me and Ricardo went and got a nice, like, you know, dinner of, like, pasta and calamari and red wine and stuff. And we're like, shoot, we know this secret, you know, that's going to really blow everybody's minds here. So it was this weird calm because the deal was done, but it wasn't public yet. And so you're carrying around this piece of information that you know is going to kind of you know, send shockwaves out around the world.
Yeah, I think one of the proudest moments I had in my life of having worked for President Obama and one of the moments I missed working at the White House the most was when you guys went on that trip with the president to Cuba.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, I mean, is there a moment or an event that jumps out at you? Was it as earth-shattering as it looked from TV? Hard-hitting questions, I know.
Yeah. No, it was. I mean you know, I'd been to Cuba by that point a few times, but landing in Cuba on Air Force One, you know, first of all, what's strange about going to Cuba is it is like 90 miles from Florida. Like you fly over the Keys and then you're like in Cuba in like 5 minutes. So like the absurdity of how removed we've been, given how close we are, sinks in. But then you think, you know, the Bay of Pigs invasion and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then here's Air Force One landing. And that moment, you know, was really powerful. And also, frankly, you see the effect of the embargo, which I'm not proud of, which is like you fly over Miami and it's this gleaming city. And then you fly over these kind of dilapidated housing structures out by the airport. And it, you know, that sinks in. But then in terms of moments, you know, I think there were so many that were so – everything – I've never done anything, even in 8 years in that job, where everything that happened was like – the first time it had ever happened.
Right.
And it was totally – so like Raul Castro took questions. Like he's never done that.
That
right?
was incredible.
Like they had a press conference. Like that was unbelievable. President of the United States standing in you know, Revolutionary Square with like Che Guevara's face in bold, on a building nearby, and the U.S. national anthem being played was incredible. When the president addressed the Cuban people, they broadcast it live. And so here he is talking about our values, our democracy, and you know that's in every Cuban home. And the audience, we negotiated this very interesting audience because there were Cuban Americans there and Cuban Americans who've opposed the mm-hmm. Castro government. And then there was Raul Castro, and they were all in the same room together. That never happened before. So everything was new. But the one anecdote that's kind of unusual that always stuck with me is it was an incredibly hard trip to organize. And you remember, Tommy.
Like, can't even imagine.
A presidential trip is always a pain to organize because we annoy the hell out of every country because we send like all this military aircraft and equipment and hundreds of people. And so there are always fights. But with Cuba, there were 10 times as many fights because they're like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, what is happening?
Is this another Bay of Pigs? Like, are you guys like, what's in that cargo plane? You know? And so our advanced staff had like a real hell of a time. And this guy, Duncan Teeter, who's like an awesome advanced guy, he was just going out of his mind and not sleeping. And he was furious and like all these fights. And he said then the day before we got there, they built a stage for this event we did on entrepreneurship. And these two Cuban guys kind of finally finished building this dais with like the Cuban and American flags behind it and sat down to have a beer. And they all just sat down and they just all started crying.
That's
because they're just looking at these flags together. Yeah. And they're like, wait a second. This is real, you know?
Yeah.